Welcome to Iconic, where we talk about all things 13th age. I'm your host, JM, and with me as always are Nick, Becca, and Mark.
Hey.
Hello.
Hey. We have a great show for you this week. We are talking about how to be a better GM. And this is sort of our companion piece to the how to be a better player episode that we did in season two. We've kind of got this broken up similarly to the way we broke up the different roles about being a player. So we're just going to kind of get into it. Now, Mark, you had a note to call out to people there.
Yeah. Don't be afraid to be that first time GM.
Right.
And your current GM will probably love a chance to play, even if it's the one shot, you know, once in a while.
So the first role that we're kind of talking about is as host, either physically or virtually. It tends to be incumbent on the GM to provide the space to play, whether that's the Roll20 account, whether that's the Fantasy Grounds account, whether that's the basement, the table, you're the host. Yeah.
Yeah. Even negotiating with a store owner, like, can I have a table in the back closet to sit here and play?
Hey. Nick plays Harry Potter games and he really tries for that versatility.
Our local game store, I like the back closet.
Yeah,
I do
too.
Kind of set a little bit quieter.
Yeah. Until you get eight people in there.
That's right. That's true. I blame JM because he lets eight people play instead of five.
I was just going to say that as a GM, it is always, it's often then you have the most stuff. Mm-hmm. So it's nice if you get to choose the location, whether that is your basement, because now you don't have to cart those buckets of minis everywhere.
Oh, yeah. I'm running two different games for Starfest, so I have to schlep many boxes of things.
Yeah.
I have books to. And
I got to do that too.
Nothing.
I'm already packed.
But I think the thing is, it's that the GM isn't necessarily responsible for having the hosting space, but they do bear the responsibility for providing access to whatever the hosting space is.
And at least in my experience, 9 times out of 10, it's one and the same. Mm-hmm. Because, and we've talked a little bit about this, if your experience is anything like mine, you start DMing because there's no one else who you want to play and no one else wants to run. So you just say, come over, we'll play a game.
Yep. That was my experience too.
Yep. So part of that is setting up the space and minimizing distractions.
I've got a space in my basement where I've got a table set up and I end up putting a TV on one end of it for those who are playing virtually. That way they feel like they are actually sitting at the table with the rest of us. But I found that sitting at the table versus lounging around on the couches really helps with just helping people stay engaged in the game itself. A lot can be said about physical posture and attentiveness. And what I found is that if people are just lounging back, then they're going to be more likely to be pulling out their phones and, you know, getting on Facebook or whatever. But if they're at the table and sitting forward, then they're going to be paying more attention, listening more closely.
Yeah, I would select an area. Even if you have a nice table, like a dining table, if you have a family or roommates and they're wanting to watch TV and you're trying to game 20 feet away, that's a distraction.
Yeah.
So try to take a space that's separate of that. I mean, we see it when we go to the game store. We're all trying to game, but if there's four tables going, it can get a little bit loud and a little distracting, even though we're all gaming. So,
yeah.
Stuff like that.
I don't have a fancy big table for my groups, so we do have to lounge. But I do try to pick the spaces that they are comfortable, but we all then sit in a circle, whether that's because some people prefer sitting on the floor and are therefore. Yeah, I have players who prefer to sit on the floor versus at a table because it's just more comfortable for them. But I do try to get everybody to face each other. Mm-hmm. Like, you don't want them all lined up on the couch. You want them across from each other so that they're going to interact with each other. And you want to be across from them yourself so that they look and interact with you, the GM.
Yeah, I've got the kind of round area downstairs. So part of the other step of being host is, I'm going to use the term, establishing the social contract. There is a social contract, whether it's explicit or implicit, of coming together with a group of friends and playing a game. Mm-hmm. At the bare minimum, it's, hey, we're showing up at this time. We are going to play from this time to this time. Be there. Be on time. Be prepared. However, there are other things. You know, what style of game are we playing? If you don't say, hey, we're playing a horrific game. I mean, I've had that happen a couple of times in our 13th Age game where I've interjected more body horror than some people are comfortable with. And I went, oh, okay, I've definitely, I got to pull that back just a little bit because there was just a couple of people who were like, ooh.
I had a player who, well, she ended up moving and so she had to find a new group to play with. And she was telling me about how she was uncomfortable with the group and she couldn't pinpoint why until we were discussing it. And I made the comment, oh, they were playing more at an R-rated level and you prefer the PG-13 rated where you know the person dies, but you don't see the blood spurt everywhere. And that really clicked for her. And so in that social contract, as JM said, like he's realized when he's overstepped it, but it is important as the GM to recognize that, that maybe your players do prefer the even PG version of something, or this group of people really wants the R-rated.
Yeah. What kind of social contracts do you guys have? And have you ever made them explicit to the players?
One of my social contracts that I'm still working through with my players is in regards to communication and expectations of communication. Because it's very frustrating as a GM who is going through all of the work of preparing a place and planning for the sessions and then have someone not show up and never say anything or something like that. Or the flip side, if it gets communicated, hey, we're not doing something, or we're canceling the session, and then someone shows up because they didn't read their email. Those sorts of things is saying, I will communicate to you. I expect you to read the communications sort of thing. But communication, I think is, I don't know, it's important to me. And I think it goes a long way of smoothing over a lot of issues and road bumps that come up in any sort of social setting.
Yeah. Yeah. In my group, that's very important because I have a small group with three people. So if one person doesn't make it, we don't game that week.
Right.
But we're pretty good as soon as we know, hey, I'm working late or today's just not going to happen, guys. See you next week. Then we let each other know as quick as we can,
right,
which is pretty good.
I don't think any of my social contracts for games have ever been explicit. And I don't know if that's just because I have people who understand, hey, when we show up, we all play, and that's right, what we're doing. I don't think I've ever had to ask a player to put away their phone and focus in the group. Because I think, at least in my experience, that's usually why we're together, so we don't want the other distractions. I don't know that I've ever had to actually explicitly, you know, show a contract and go sign it.
I don't think that we're talking like that.
No.
But there is, like, for example, one of my friends, BC, has at their board game, I mean, he doesn't role play, but at their board game group, they have just said, hey, these are how we're going to play. So things like, I don't have to take an optimal turn every turn. Everyone's enjoyment is more important than me spending 30 minutes to, you know, just stuff like that, just so that there is, do you bring food? Do you not bring food? Phones out. What is considered acceptable language? And most of these things, and I think as well-rounded, mature adults, you can pick up after about three or four sessions. You'll realize, ooh, well, nope, that's a corner I shouldn't have gone into, or, okay, people are bringing food, I should pitch in, that sort of thing. I don't know that I've ever actually explicitly stated any of these things, but for the most part, I mean, I've had to talk to one or two people one or two times.
And I think that it's those sorts of social agreements, social contracts, whatever you want to call it, I think those are normally implicit until there's an issue.
Until there's an issue.
And then once you have to address it, then it becomes explicit.
But again, the more things, like when you're setting up a group for the first time, if you're doing a setting doc or a handout that says, hey, here's the pitch for the game, putting a couple of things in there, like, hey, here's also when I expect to play. Hey, let's do dinner beforehand, or let's bring something, or, hey, definitely going to keep the themes in this area. We all come to GMing for our friends most of the time. More things, we assume that everything's going to work out well, but the more things that we can clearly communicate, the better it is.
Yeah, for a lot of groups, like you said, it's already implicit because they're friends already. Mm-hmm. If you're starting a new group and looking for players, and say you hang up a notice in your game store, and so you have people showing up that you don't know,
right?
It's probably safer to start like at G level, get to know them, see where they're comfortable,
or even
and then go, hey, is it okay if we, you know, as maybe topics come up or language comes up, you kind of broach that. Is everybody cool with this, or is anyone uncomfortable? And then move forward and kind of thing. And then you can maybe put it out saying, hey, I think it's a good idea since we have 8 people here. Why don't we take turns bringing snacks, mm-hmm. you know, or if you're have a certain dietary restriction, feel free to bring your own snacks kind of thing. And, you know, that's okay.
Or if you're playing at a game store, going to the owner and just say, Hey, what's the vibe of the store? Is this more of a family store? Is this more of like a hardcore gaming store? That sort of thing. The other thing that you need to communicate clearly as part of this social agreement, and I like agreement better than contract, Nick, is house rules. If you're making house rules, which we'll get to GM as designer later, you need to make those clear. If you change how wood elves work and don't tell anybody until after character creation, you're pulling the rug out from under somebody, right? We're agreeing to play 13th Age. If you have house rules, let people know that. When I did the 13th Age Planescape game and I changed how icons worked, everyone had that weeks in advance so that they could know, here's how I'm looking at doing this differently.
Mm-hmm.
You guys ever done house rules, anything that you've changed and tried to clarify to the players?
Yes, and it's usually we play with a rule and be like, you know what, this doesn't really make sense to us. Let's change it. We agree on it. I write it down, but I also give them the caveat that we might change it in the future if it doesn't work. Mm. And I've done that before too, with to try to keep games moving. Look at a rule. Well, I'm not too sure. Okay, we're going to do it this time. I write it down and then I'll look at it later outside the game. But then the next session I'll say, oh, hey, you know what? I thought about this. It's not going to work. Let's make this the rule for right. sure. Not just, you know, but I'll let them know. Here's the ruling for now. We'll go forward for the game. For tonight, that's what the rule is, but it might change in the future. Yeah. Just because sometimes you're like, ooh, I made a ruling and it broke the game. So,
well, we are playing a rules set, 13th Age. Jonathan and Rob have done a great job designing this game. But there is part of the GM's role to be a game designer. Mm-hmm. And whether that's house rules, whether that's setting, we're going to talk about that as our next topic. So first thing is, and it goes back to setting up the theme, is you have to set up the framework of the game. Now, Mark, you've set up a 13th Age game most recently.
I did. And they asked for it. We finished one game and they're like, hey, you know, we heard about this game. We'd like to try it. So I was okay. Here's 13th Age, and, you know, showed them the rules and went over kind of what the changes. They're all familiar with D&D. So here's the changes for 13th Age. And since we were starting brand new, I was like, you know what? Here, let's do this Engine of the Ages. And I got immediate buy-in. Got a whiteboard, mm-hmm. explained how it worked, and they loved it. They kind of set the stage of where they're at right now and who did stuff. And they came up with fantastic stories of why it happened. You know, back That's in awesome. The 5th Age, what happened here. And like, oh, yeah, it makes sense. And just, it was mm-hmm. fun. So they got immediate buy-in for that. So I think they're enjoying it. They're still first level, so they're chugging along. I mean, so that's one way. I like that, you know, because it sets, instead of saying, here's my world playing it, it's okay, you guys set up the past, and they kind of, and it helps them understand icons and the roles they're playing and who's going to be important for their game. So right. it worked out really well.
Mm-hmm. For our Envir Vale game, we did character creation first with just a brief out, you know, sketch of, we're going to be playing on this border frontier of the Dragon Empire. And then after you guys made your characters, I went through your icons, and that's how I gave everybody a setting doc, 5 or 6 pages, but mm-hmm. everybody's icons, those were the icons that I focused in on. But right. those are two different ways right. to set up the setting.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
For sure. When I've been starting a game, well, when I started, I didn't have much and nobody else had anything either. So it was, well, here's this town and here's one person who needs help. And I think with that designer part, getting those NPCs to get player buy-in is important. And mm-hmm. a lot of times in any adventure that you get NPCs there, but you, as the GM, bring them to life, whether that is with voices and excitement, or if it's just, this person needs help, here's why you should care. But that part, like, it's there from other people, but you as the GM have to mm-hmm. provide that base.
With 13th Age, and I would say with two varying degrees with other games, but especially with 13th Age, you need to hold on to your framework pretty loosely.
Yes. Players will change things. And sometimes it's the way the story goes and how choices, like you said, NPCs, you have a shopkeeper to sell them swords. suddenly that's the most important person in town and they latch onto that person. Mm-hmm. And you're like, okay, I guess I'll develop the background of
Frederick.
Yeah. Frederick, the shopkeeper.
Yeah. But I mean, you also have in 13th Age with icons and backgrounds and one unique things, you have players have ways to meaningfully impact quickly that framework. And so I don't want to say it gets bent out of shape, but it quickly takes on different shapes than you initially thought.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And this is a thing where a lot of conversations end up talking about that slider between a railroad campaign and a sandbox campaign. And I think that 13th Age fits really nicely in the middle, where it's helpful to have, as a game designer, helpful to have that framework of a plot arc that you're going to be taking the players on, but giving the players leeway through their one unique things, their icon relationships, their backgrounds to wander in and around and through that and really complement that main arc that you're trying to drive.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, other players have mentioned to me about just different games that they have been in where as a GM and you design things and you set up the rules, it is important as that GM to be flexible about those rules, sort of. If a person wants to climb a tree to keep watch that night, you don't need to spend 30 minutes telling them that, well, you're only going to have partial visibility because of the leaves, because it's summer and this tree has full leaves. Great. Like, that's something that doesn't need to be the focus of a 30-minute discussion. However, if everybody in your game wants to fly, you should probably hold on to those rules of physics a little bit tighter. So it's that flexibility of what is an important rule as a designer. The fact that gravity still exists is probably an important rule. The fact that trees have leaves in the summer, yes, but that's one you can work around.
Well, and I would say, especially in like the case of flight, right? Some of these things are covered at higher levels.
Right.
And so if players want to do them at lower levels, we are still playing a game. And so you're right. As a GM, you need to know when to say, this doesn't matter. Yeah, all right. This one's kind of a bigger deal. Mm-hmm. So my wife gave me this acronym from one of her hobbies called Casing It. She makes cards. Your wife does that as well, Mark. And they have an acronym where they say, you know, you case it, you copy and steal everything. Mm. And as a designer, I think that is super important.
Oh, yeah.
The more you read, the more you watch, the more you take in fantasy or science fiction or the style of stuff that you are going to do or play in other people's games or watch Critical Role, the more you take in, the more you will synthesize and the better designer, whether it's setting, story, or mechanics, that you will be.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. I came into Critical Role late. I'm playing catch up. And I love it. And I told my players, oh, you got to watch this. And then the next week, like, you guys can't watch this because I'm stealing Matt's everything. Stuff. I was like, no, that whole Durger City. I was like, nope, yeah. Nope, don't watch it. Yeah, watch the first episode, get the flavor, and then that's
wrong.
It.
I was wrong.
Don't watch it because I'm stealing all of it.
Yeah.
It's fantastic. Oh, yeah.
Anytime that I need an NPC, it's probably going to be either from a book I've read, another game I've played in, or something that I've watched recently. And I'm like, here's this person. And I can describe them in great detail. And everybody goes, oh, you're so good at coming up with NPCs. And I'm like, yeah, yes. Don't go watch that TV show. don't do it, please.
But it's also okay if they do recognize that Legolas character that you're introducing, because they can picture it. And they got that, oh, great, I got it. And that buy-in of understanding what you're presenting.
Yeah,
I got done with one session one time and a player came up to me and said, did you take this from this TV show? It's like, yes, definitely. And good for you for noticing.
Right. Well, there was in our Pathfinder game where you were like, this feels very Lies of Loch Lamora. I'm like, yeah, no, because Becca asked what the Thieves Guild was like. And I was like, all right, here's what I'm going with, because I had nothing. Like, I did not have that fleshed out as much. Yeah. So the more games you plan, the more you're going to see how other people do things. I take a bunch of stuff from Mark, having played in his games.
I steal everything JM does too.
And this is where it's helpful even to read other gaming systems as well. I mean, as much as we love 13th Age, it's based in an F20 fantasy world. Mm-hmm. And so reading other D20, F20 fantasy worlds, it could give you a lot of inspiration and stuff that you can just grab from and restat and you're ready to go with it.
Right. And 13th Age is mature enough in its life cycle, if you will. you've got all of the Dragon Empire stuff. Wade and Ash and a couple of other people have put together a lot of Midgard stuff. Setting is completely different. There's enough rules in there for 13th Age that you could port Midgard in pretty easily. So why not go read a more Eastern European version of fantasy? Primeval Thule, which we did in season one, has a very Conan meets Cthulhu feel. So why wouldn't you go out and read it and go, what can I steal and pull in here?
Oh, I do that all the time. I'll take stuff from first edition, DCC, One Ring. Doesn't matter. It's the adventure. I can come up with the stats.
And if you go online and even just spend a little bit of time, there's a ton of free material. Like it doesn't always have to be, well, let me go spend $10 or $20 or $30 on this book. All right. Well, the next role we're going to talk about is the GM as collaborator, because 13th Age is such a collaborative system right from the get-go. All role-playing games, you should be a collaborator with your players. If someone comes to you with a really cool character arc that they want to deal with, you know, let's work that in. If you, our friend Josh kind of says he always wants to provide a character that he would want to have in his game, where there's just so many hooks and storylines that the GM can just take whatever they want and run with it. 13th Age is built from the ground up to have that level kind of baked in immediately.
Mm-hmm. I would say this collaborator role is one of the most important as a GM, because it ties back to that whole, our fun is important. Mm-hmm. So I can have the best story in the world, but if I'm going to completely ignore your one unique thing and your backstory, you have less of a buy-in in my story. And I want you to buy in. I want you to be involved. So I'm going to use that long lost cousin. Hey, now that's the main villain.
Yeah.
Right.
If you're ignoring your players and their characters, you probably should be writing a novel.
Yes.
Right. Yes.
If your players can't actually make any meaningful impact and you're not actually spending time to collaborate with them, that's fine. But go write a novel.
Yeah. And not that every session has to have everybody, but
right. This
time might be JM's character that has the spotlight. Next time it'd be Nick's, you know, so. But yeah, right. If you completely, like, I'm playing a paladin with Great Gold Worm. If we never meet demons and that never comes up in JM's game that we're playing now, my guy's like, okay, why am I playing this paladin with Great Gold Worm? I don't get to do anything.
Yeah. So you want to, like, incorporate, like, the three things that we talked about. We just talk about over and over again as being kind of the core of this mechanic, our backgrounds, one unique things, and icons. And if you go back and look at some of our other episodes in previous seasons, we've talked about what are unique ways to use backgrounds. You don't always have to call for a background role. If someone has a background, just when you're prepping and go, oh man, Nick has that background in, you know, unholy fiddle playing. Well, what would he just know walking into a
session?
Yeah.
Or maybe even just trying to figure out how, you know, Nick hasn't gotten much of a spotlight lately. I'm trying to figure out an NPC. Oh, I'm going to make a filmmaker.
Yeah.
And weave that, you know, direct tie into his background and maybe even have a previous connection there.
You are way nicer than me. I would be like, cool, the devil shows up with a golden fiddle. See how well you roll. But when you're prepping, right, give yourself some room for how the icons come up. But also, I'm going to go back to Envier Vale. There were maybe 7 icons that were picked between the players. I'm not going to focus on any of the other icons because why would I?
Well, you get 7, so you have plenty to deal
exactly.
with.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a little heavy-handed right now with the group. One had played before in 13th Age, Kyle and
Kyle,
The other two haven't, so I say heavy-handed. I try to pull on the backgrounds and have them explain more to try to get them into that and try to set more things that are canon. It's like, okay, you've got to do this. Do you have a background? It's like, well, I've got this. Okay, well, explain it more. How does that apply? What did you do? Mm-hmm. And I'll make a note. Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. So I'm trying to tell them, no, the things that you bring up now become history of the world. So,
well, and that is, in my opinion, one of the great 13th Age GM tricks. Just push it back to the player. If they ask you, well, what do I know? I'm like, well, what would you know as, you know, a former dwarven mining bot? Mm-hmm. What would you know? Well, would I know X, Y, or Z? Well, cool. Give me a role. Who was it? It was Josh.
And
Josh was like, when he was explaining, we had some new players come to play with us. and he was like, listen, your character knows way more about this world and story than you do. So always be asking, what does my character know? What does my background give me? And as a GM, like, push back, like, give that back to the players. You don't always have to have an answer off the top of your head.
And at the same time, the characters may not always know the right answer.
Mm-hmm.
So you could take what they give you and twist it and say, well, because this doesn't quite fit with the overall theme of things that I'm trying to craft here. What you heard is partly true, but not entirely true.
Mm-hmm. And collaboration does not mean handing it off to one person, but it does mean taking what everyone is doing and synthesizing something new.
Yeah. Well, it, not for knowledge, but my group has a Forgeborn, Dwarven Forged character, and they've come up because he's like, so do I have Infravision? Which 13th Age doesn't really touch on. But they all collaboratively like, well, you know, the dwarves made him to see underground. So yeah, his eyes light up.
That's awesome.
So I let him have that as their light source. So it's like he doesn't get a bonus that he can see in the dark and no one else. Mm-hmm. It's like, yeah, you can see because your lights are like flashlights. So that's their light source as they wander through the Underdark.
That's awesome.
Yeah, that's cool.
So how do we keep track of all of this? Well, in the 13th Age rule book, there is the icon chart, which is something very simple to kind of keep track of. What are some other ways that you guys keep track of information, whether it's just generally or specifically for 13th Age?
I've got I made a handy spreadsheet for all the different players that lists their one unique things, mm-hmm. their backgrounds, their icons, what points they have with them, and then a lot of room to write notes and consequences and hooks. And that way, at the end of the session, I can go back in and say, these are the things that I want to make sure that I'm emphasizing in some future session, and then can come back around with that.
Right.
So that's kind of a general thing. And I like that because I can easily print it off in a one sheet thing and have it in front of me for the game sessions. But generally, my notes end up in OneNote, in different sections for PCs and NPCs, cities, campaign hooks, you know, those sorts of things.
So Nick's an IT guy, if you haven't figured that out. I use 3x5 cards. I mean, I have my regular notes, but for player stuff, I have 3x5s mm-hmm. that I can put right in front of me and flip through real quick. Just little things I need for them. They're handier than flipping through, especially if you play a longer campaign, you know. You're flipping through a notebook 10, 20 pages back going, where did I write that down? If I got a little note card saying I gave JM this and it's cursed and he doesn't know yet, I've got that on the card.
Yeah. I find that doing session write-ups at the end of the session is very helpful for me, partially because it means I'm synthesizing what happened that night. I go, all right, well, what did I see as really what happened? Cool. Now I have a very fixed point in my mind, something I can go back to.
And Jam's a novelist, so he has to write.
I do
that out. So. But it's good. That's how you process it.
Personally, I use a notebook to do the overarching stuff. And then each game session, I do have 3x5 cards for monsters, special items, other things. And then that way, as they're killing the monsters, I can just write on the note card versus trying to keep track somewhere else how many hit points are left on this thing.
I just write it in your book.
I know you do. Yeah. It's fine.
This guy's dead.
But as JM was bringing up, one of the things that he has done that is really cool, and I would like him to do it for other games, is start essentially a site that has tabs for any player to access to read up the synopsis of what is happening, to look at NPCs, to see who's dead and who's alive and how they relate to you, to find all that like information that we talk to somebody in that one place. Where is it? Oh, sweet. It's just, I can just go straight to the NPC tab. In an online game that we've started, we were gifted a document about the background of this place. And I just started typing in it because I put in my character and I said, this is Vesrin's journal. And I just started typing through that whole session and then I'll go back and I'll highlight an asterisk. And I started an NPC list. And I was like, this was really helpful to be able to pull up. at any time.
And that's something that I had on as an idea of how to be a better GM is actually taking that step forward and doing those session recaps mm-hmm. and those write-ups. It's interesting. We had talked about that in the being a better player, that as a player, you could be doing these. And I think as a GM, it's helpful not only for your own planning's sake, but it is something that you can give back to your players that if they're curious a couple days mm-hmm. before the session starts, hey, what happened? Then they have that they can go back and refresh their memory.
Yeah.
Or a place for a player to add to it. And they're going, but mm-hmm. I thought this was really important. You didn't mention it in your write-up. And so then the GM, we get to see, oh, you added that. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that was important to you. I just thought it was a flyby comment, but.
Did you notice, because GM likes to do the recap. I don't know, you do the recap now, but I think you used to go around the room and in different systems, you would give even a bonus of experience of, hey, do the recap to encourage note-taking. But you ever notice as you go around when different people do recaps, how they emphasize different aspects mm-hmm. of a last session.
Oh, yeah.
You say what's important to them, what they picked up on. Not, yeah, we didn't, okay, we fought a Balor, who cares? They might have talked 10 minutes on the innkeeper they met. And mm-hmm. like, yeah, we fought a Balor. That was important to them.
Yeah, there's really strange inscriptions on that treasure chest. Yeah. Well, we just spent a lot of time trying to figure out what that was.
Yes.
So what, that we just killed this dragon, you know? So yeah. we're all about this treasure chest.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That trapped you?
Yeah.
So the last role is you will have times where you have to officiate or adjudicate or you know, be an arbiter of the rules. No game system can cover everything. And I'm looking right at you, GURPS. I know you try, but you can't. And so as the GM, it's your job to mediate disputes, whether they're over rules or interpersonal things at the table. If Mark keeps stealing things from Nick, let me rephrase that.
Raise Mark's perception.
If Mark's character keeps stealing things from Nick's character and it's starting to bleed out of character into the interpersonal part of the group, as the GM, I feel like that's a little bit of your responsibility. And I'm not trying to say that that's a reason you shouldn't GM, but just realize that when people have questions, you're going to be the natural person they go to.
Actually, that is one action in for a long time going back systems that I never liked and never really got why people would do that. It's one thing if the thief, hey, look, we found some stuff, and he keeps some on the sly. It's another thing to go and take stuff from another character because I've got this fantastic pickpocket. It's like you're sowing discord for no reason. That's where you want to maybe talk to him offline and go, why did you do that? Now, if he's like, well, I really needed that, you know, the brooch of Ariel they had because of this. Oh, okay, I can see that. But just generally taking coins and things and
people's holy books.
Yeah, this is kind of one of those house rules that I had to sit down and talk with my players through at one point was I love player and player interaction or character and character interaction with each other. But there's a point where it switches from just interacting to being like PvP.
Antagonistic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so there was one point where I had to sit down and tell my players, hey, look, this is what my thought was. This is what I think that we're all supposed to be working together on this. If you guys want to be going after each other, that is okay in these situations. And here's what the rules are going to be for this. Mm-hmm. If this becomes an issue, we're going to stop playing.
Right. Now with there, and again, this is going back to like theme and discussing with your players. If you're, when I was running Infinity, all right, that's a game about different factions coming together for a unified purpose, but each person still having their own shadowy reasons that they're here and maybe a mission that is parallel to the group's. You know, we talked about it beforehand. I'm like, how spy do you want this to be? And everyone agreed, well, as long as my personal mission is not to stop the group mission, I'm okay with that. And we had some tense moments between players, but we were able to move past them because that was the theme of the game. It does not work as well if you do that, say, in a D&D group or an F20 group or a 13th age group where you're trying to work together, unless, again, from the start, everyone has agreed to, okay, this is really, we're really playing up a heavy Prince of Shadows sort of wilderness of mirrors sort of thing.
But even then, at certain points, you know, when you, and I've done this when you ask, you're like, why'd you do that? Like, well, I'm a thief. That's what I have to steal. Yeah, no, you don't have to do that.
Well, yeah, just on a side note, I had that happen in a 2E game that I was playing, and I was playing the cleric. And so I was like, cool, what's the going rate for a second level healing spell? Excellent. I'm not healing you until you pay me this much gold. Well, why are you doing that? Listen, if you're going to steal from me because you're the thief, I'm going to charge you for healing because I'm the cleric. That ended that discussion.
That's brilliant.
Yeah. This goes back and emphasizes the point that we've made a couple of times that our fun is more important than my fun.
Exactly. And if you need a little bit more view of this, go check out Matt Coville's video, The Wang Rod Defense, which talks specifically about the thief-cleric interaction and kind of this whole phenomena in a little bit more specificity. All right. Well, to wrap up the show, we're going to talk about specific 13th Age things that we think are really important to remember. We already talked a little bit about pushing things back to the players. What's going on? I don't know. Give me an icon relationship roll to see what's going on, or a background roll. And that's kind of what I wrote down. When in doubt, roll icon relationships and shout. Remember, you can, and this is covered in the GM resource book, if you ever reach a point where you're like, wow, I really don't know who made that weapon or what that guy's relationship is to the group, or all right, everyone, give me icon relationship rolls. Whatever comes up most, that's what I'm going with. I've even used icon relationship rolls behind the screen a couple of times just to kind of get a little bit of better idea of what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
13th Age also has fail forward. Failing does not mean you don't get your goal. You just don't get your goal in the stated way, or it's complicated. The example I like to use is if Nick's character is trying to pick a lock and he fails, he still might pick a lock, but what he expected on the other side of the door is not what's actually there. Or perhaps guards show up, so he gets the door open, but not in time to do X, mm-hmm. Y, and Z.
Trips an alarm.
Definitely as a GM, I prefer the fail forward mechanic to looking at my players and going, well, you're out of luck. Try something else. Because a lot of times they might feel like they are in a stuck situation and they're going, well, it's either I'm able to pick the lock or I blow down the door. And when I do that, I don't have any actual like useful explosives. All I have is this hogshead of gunpowder. And the next thing you know, the palace is in flames. I'd prefer the fail forward where they don't feel like they failed.
You make sound like burning down a castle is a bad thing.
It depends on whether or not it's your family's castle. Yeah. Or someone else's. I think that ties into the 13th Age, the mm-hmm. players are heroes.
Yes, and that's kind of always ask yourself as the GM, how are the characters the heroes in this session? They should never feel like, as much as I enjoy it, and I think we're all having fun with it, it should not, 13th Age should not have the same feel as a Castles and Crusades game, where you're like, we don't want to go back in there because we just got our rears handed to us. Like, there may be moments of that in 13th Age, but it's not because you weren't heroic enough.
I don't know. Greg's pretty heroic.
Greg is pretty heroic.
Well, this is something that one of our patrons, Tim, had submitted as an idea about thinking about scenes cinematically, because the players are heroes, mm-hmm. right? And so it's helpful to be thinking about this as if I was watching a superhero movie, what sort of things are going to be happening cinematically? And then his suggestion was to describe it in that way, using at least two of the five senses, just to kind of get that player investment, but also to reinforce the idea that, okay, you're not just a farmer picking up a sharpened plow, you know?
Yeah. I'll be running that at Starfest.
DCC.
Yeah.
One of the other things that I have done, but I'm not very consistent about it, and I'm trying to get better at it, is the idea that at the end of the session, asking the players, hey, what's one thing out of the session that you definitely want to see as a reoccurring theme? They put it in there for a reason. It's a really good piece of advice. Mm-hmm. Like, is there an NPC that you guys are like, man, I really want this person to come back? Or we heard this rumor, I really want this thing to come back.
As we moved on about the rules arbitration, yeah, kind of finishing notes, one of the things I do, especially with a new group, even if you know the rule, have the player look it up.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of times, too, they read the rule, like, oh, I want to do that. Okay, well, what's the rule say? And then you can also, okay, well, you look up the rule. All right, read the rule. And a lot of times the light bulb will go off and like, mm-hmm. oh, okay, I got it. And you don't have to make a ruling because it's there. Sometimes you have to make a ruling because like, well, I see it this way. And then you'll have to arbitrate it. But a lot of times the light bulb just goes off and they're like, okay, cool. And then everybody at the table knows.
Oh, that's how it works.
Mm-hmm. Or you can do that.
That's kind of one of the fun things about 13th Age is that the rules, especially for out of combat stuff, it's really like wibbly wobbly. So as far as arbitration in 13th Age, you can give the players a lot of leeway. You know, if they see that, hey, I've got this spell that I can cast in combat, can't I do something maybe similar out of combat? And I was like, okay, well, can you do rituals? Well, yeah. Okay. Well, let's talk through how you could do this.
Right.
It's pretty easy to, you know, we've talked before about pushing it back on the players again and again. 13th Age is built for that.
Kind of equal and opposite in combat. Things are very ultra locked down, but for, you know, for the balance of the game, there are some very specific limitations. And so that's where more of the arbitration, I think, would come in. And there, I've had very few moments in 13th Age where I've been like, yeah, no, I think you're reading that completely wrong. There have been times.
Yeah, not often. I can't really think when it stands out that you had to really, okay, here's how the rule really works. Sometimes I'll ask, like, can I do that? And you're like, no, yes, you know, or kick back, what's it say?
Yeah. And that's where house rules come from, where you look at it and you go, no, this is how we are going to play this rule. And it's worth putting in a document and saying,
leave my wood elf alone.
No, I'm totally changing that.
But even in combat, you know, there's a question of, can I go climb up this ladder and then jump off and gain a bonus on my downward slash?
Yep.
It's like, exactly. I mean, the 13th Age, even in those instances in combat, it's loose enough to allow for that type of arbitration. Now, obviously, it's a dicey move, so they're going to have to do a skill check to attempt
it. Right. You push it back like that.
But again, as far as that cinematic feel for it, if that's what the players are really asking about rules-wise, can I do this? Sure. Give me a roll.
That's why I put a 6 in Gladiator.
Right.
And we've talked a number of times about how heroic and cinematic and player-focused 13th Age is. And because that is a core element of this game system, I think it's really important to find a way to reward good role-playing on the part of the players. Mm-hmm. If you want the players to continue to be doing the things that the players are supposed to be doing at 13th Age, you need to find a way of rewarding them. Maybe that's a mechanical benefit. Maybe they get a temporary background that gives them an extra +1 or +2 or something to that regard. Maybe it's a completely out of game thing where you're going to cover their drink next time, or you know what their favorite snack is, and it's like, hey guys, this was a really good role playing session, I'm going to buy pizza next week.
Right.
You know, something along those lines, but giving them some hook to continue to invest as players into their characters.
And I would say, kind of building off that, if you have somebody who's a really good role player and constantly engaging, they're awesome. Don't stop encouraging them. But when the quiet person steps out and does something, really, really encourage them in that moment. Be like, yes, that was awesome. Not don't point at them and make them feel like you're singling them out, but do give them their moment of, hey, like, well done. Good job.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Especially with those new people who show up to your game and there's 5 experienced players.
She had air quotes there.
I did. Yeah. And they're sitting there staring at people interacting and, you know, fighting in character. And when they finally step in and they go, this is why I hate people, or why my character hates people, and why I'm out in the woods all the time. And if you give me food, fine, I'll put up with your bickering. And you're like, yay, newbie, you bought in.
That's right.
I'm so happy right now.
All right. Well, if you have any questions or ideas on how to be a better GM, or what you do that you feel is a skill that you would want to share with everyone else, drop us a line, shoot us an email, post in our comment section on this episode. Let us know.
Ciao.
And if you'd like to support the show, you can do so by becoming a patron at patreon.com/iconicpodcast, or by using our Amazon referral link, which you can find in our show notes or on our website, to do your online shopping. Well, you've been listening to the Iconic Podcast.
If you have any questions, comments, or feedback, you can contact us at iconicpodcast@gmail.com or call and leave a voicemail at 720-924-1706.
And be sure to check out iconicpodcast.com for news, updates, and new episodes.
Thanks for listening.